Now we can look. Draw everything together a little bit and just have a look at how the cessation of suffering how it happens and bringing together what the path of practice and the tenets of realization everything in a very nice manner. So we're going to come back to the sutta on ignorance or delusion that we looked at, the Avijja Sutta that we looked at the beginning. And we're going to look at the second half of that sutta and then tie it in the dependent cessation and see how the whole thing ceases as a consequence of that. So, this sutta then goes as follows. Remember that it's about the nutriment of various things, and this is what the Buddha has to say. I say to you that true knowledge and liberation have a nutriment. Okay, are not without nutriment. What is the nutriment of true knowledge and liberation? It should be said the seventh factors of awakening. True knowledge here is Viksha. Venerable Vijayabodhi translates as true knowledge. And I have been translating Viksha as insight, because I think insight is a very useful translation. It certainly means the insight, the idea of seeing the world in a new way, changing our attitude to things. And of course, this is important in dealing with dependent origination, because the problem, the root problem of dependent origination is avijja. And here we are learning how to turn that avijja into vijja instead. How to go from delusion to insight. Insight is the opposite of illusion. One is seeing things clearly, the other one is seeing things that not seeing things at all. So what we are looking at now, we're looking at what is it that causes the avijja, the root problem of dependent origination. What is that causing that to disappear? Yeah? So we get avijja at the root rather than actually having avijja. Of course, if we do that, then obviously the whole dependent origination is going to unravel. And this is what I will show you in a second once I go through this. But now, what we're looking at now is how exactly that avijja comes to disappear. So true knowledge, liberation, of course, again, just means liberation, vimutti, liberation from suffering, liberation from defilements, all that kind of stuff. But they have a nutriment. Yeah, there's a nutriment that makes these things grow. What is that nutriment? The seven factors of awakening. Yeah, what are the seven factors of awakening? You know what they are then? Yeah, the mindfulness, yes, sati, sambuddhanga, mindfulness, awakening, dhamma vichaya, sambuddhanga, the investigation of dhammas, virya, sambuddhanga, the energy, pitti, sambuddhanga, the joy or the rapture, pasati, sambuddhanga, and then samadhi, sambuddhanga, and then upeka, sambuddhanga, the last one. Seven sambuddhanga, seven factors of awakening there. What are they all about? And when you know them, when you look at them in context, it's very obvious what these things are about. They are really about samadhi and the path into samadhi. Yeah? All of these factors concern samadhi. Samadhi is actually one of them. And then you have upeka, which is there. Upeka is the, of course, the higher kind of samadhi that you have in the fourth jhana, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's the upeka. It's all about samadhi practice. This reinforces this idea that to be able to have real insight on the Buddhist path, that samadhi is a nutriment for real insight. Samadhi is what matters. That is why the fourth factor of noble path is the four jhanas. Sampa samadhi is the four jhanas. So once you get samadhi, that is really where the insight starts to happen. Ideally, you take that samadhi all the way to upeka, to the fourth jhana. That is when you have the most powerful mind of all. And that is when you are almost certain that you're going to make a breakthrough to some sort of insight. But the Sambuddhanga is actually a really beautiful set of teachings. They're very similar to what I would call dependent liberation in the sutras. The sequence of factors that actually lead to liberation eventually. But it's similar to that. So you start off with sati. And sati, of course, refers to Satipatthana. Then you have the Dhammavichaya Sambuddhanga, the idea of investigation of phenomena, understanding which things are a hindrance to samadhi and which things are beneficial. Understanding light and dark qualities. blameworthy and blameless quality, etc. So that is all about. So it's really about understanding your mind thoroughly so you can abandon all the defilements. And once you do that, you abandon all the defilements, then that is when energy arises in the mind. The mind, which is free from defilement, is naturally energetic. Energy doesn't mean you apply yourself, it just means that it's there. You have energy automatically because the defilements are gone. And I'm sure you can all know that to some extent, then when your mind is purer, you feel more energetic inside it. When you have all kinds of defilements, often kind of drags you down, makes life much more unbearable. And with the energy always comes the rapture. Yeah, rapture, the joy and things are always there together with the energy when the defilements are going down. And now we're looking at what's happening in meditation. Yeah, this is almost exactly in parallel with the Anapanasati Sutta, the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. This sequence is almost exactly the same you see through here. Then from that rapture, from the happiness and joy, comes the pasati, the tranquility of the body. This is the way you start to feel, oh, I could sit here forever. Have you had that feeling? Everything is so solid. Everything is just so nice. Everything is so peaceful. Yeah? It's like you feel like it's a rock. You can't move anymore. Then you know the story of the rock. The story of the rock is as follows. The story of the rock is, this was a story from Thailand. Adam Ram was, of course, he stayed in the northeast of Thailand, Lumpur Charles Monastery, Adam Charles Monastery in the northeast. Adam Ram was always incredibly powerful samadhi. Yeah, he was not always, because in the early days he also had a lot of struggle for grip, but he kind of always came back to his very powerful samadhi practice. And one day, every evening they have a puja, they have meditation together, the lay people would be there, everybody would be there. And then one day, Adam Ram was so still, there was no movement. If you go into a very deep samadhi, you become like a rock, pasadi, completely still, no breathing, nothing, everything is gone. And this layperson was sitting there, she was looking at this monk. And after a while, after looking at him, seeing no movement for many hours, she was getting really concerned. So she went outside and said, there's a monk in the monastery sitting on the bed, he has died. And you can see why, because when your samadhi is so good, when you don't move at all, there's nothing at all, it looks like you are dead. This is kind of the meaning of pasadi, when they come to discover incredibly deep. No breath, nothing is visible. All we see is this rock stillness. And it's kind of eerie, almost scary if you see that, because it's kind of very unnatural. Human beings aren't normally like that. So that is the pasadi for you. And this is something that very deep thing we're talking about here. From the pasadi comes the real samadhi. This is where you get the jhanas and all these kind of things. And then you get the fourth jhana from that. This is the process of meditation that is being described here. This is what happens if you do anapanasati in the right way. People who say anapanasati, just a preliminary thing, they don't understand what they're talking about. Anapanasati is a practice that takes you all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. And you will see when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, it goes all the way to the very end, it takes you all the way to Arahantship. It fulfills Vipsa Vimuti, fulfills insight and liberation, just watching the breath. Isn't that nice? All you have to do is watch the breath. It's good news, isn't it? I'd like to teach the teachings. I'd like to know, okay, what do I have to do? I have to be kind. Two, I have to wash my breath. Anything else? No, that's it. Okay, kind of wash breath, that's simple. That's all we have to do. Bring the things back to earth. Please make them simple. Because when they are simple, we can do them. We're able to practice them. So that is the seven factors of awakening leading to liberation. So basically samadhi leading to liberation. And then the Buddha says, the seven factors of awakening too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening? It should be said the four establishing, the four applications of mindfulness. That is another one of those very interesting things that people often, we often forget, but I'd like to kind of reiterate every time I talk about meditation practice. And that is that the four satipatthanas, what is the purpose of the four satipatthanas? It's to lead to samadhi. Yeah, it's right here. It's not only here, but it's again and again in the sutras. Satipatthana, when practiced in the right way, leads to samadhi. And it's so important, why does it lead to samadhi? And The reason is because one of the main functions of Satipatthana practice is to overcome the last remnant of the five hindrances. And when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, you see that it talks about the defilements of the mind, how to understand them, how to overcome them. It's the main theme of the Satipatthana Sutta. So of course, if you understand them and you overcome them, then of course it must lead to samadhi as a consequence. This is always the purpose of Satipatthana, is to actually lead you to samadhi, and then the deep insight becomes possible. So what does that mean? Is Satipatthana, is it samatha? Is Satipatthana, is it vipassana? What kind of practice is it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's exactly the same. Because everything is, when you practice the meditation right, it is both things. It is both samatha and vipassana. You cannot really disentangle these things in that way. Yeah. So, and this is, yeah. So this is what's going on here. And if you remember the reverse sequence that we were looking at before, right, we're talking about the nutriment for avijja. The nutriment for avijja was the five hindrances, yeah? So the five hindrances is a nutriment for avijja. The bhujanga and satipatthana are at the opposite place in the sequence of the hindrances, and they are opposed to the hindrances. These are the things you do to get rid of the hindrances. Satipatthana leading to samadhi. Satipatthana in turn can be really reduced to mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati. Just to keep it super simple. The four establishments, or the four applications of mindfulness too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of the four establishments of mindfulness? It should be said, the three kinds of good conduct. Yeah, sila, body, speech and mind. Good conduct of body, speech and mind, in other words, kindness. Yeah, kindness, such an important thing on the Buddhist path. That is what makes meditation possible. This is why sila is so important for meditation practice. Without it, meditation is not going to take off. One of the necessary conditions for it to work out. What are the three kinds, the nutriment for the three kinds of good conduct? It should be said, restraint of the sense faculties. Yes, why? Why is that the case? What has restraint of the sense faculties to do with the three kinds of good conduct? And the answer is that if we are going to be able to think clearly, not to get upset and angry about things, we have to have clarity about what's going on in our mind. Yeah? If you have no clarity about what's going on in your mind, if you haven't got that sense of what's happening, you won't be able to control, you won't be able to shift your attention to avoid the strong desires, to avoid anger, all these kind of things. So if you want to have a mind which is pure, then you need that sense restraint to be able to hold back and shift your attention whenever a defilement is about to arise. So sense restraint, all that really means is awareness and wisdom coming together. You have enough awareness to know what's going on, and you have enough wisdom to change your attention to avoid defilements from arising. That's really what it means. Only then can you purify the three kinds of good conduct. And that's why you have that sequence there. What is the nutriment for the sense restraint? It is the mindfulness and clear comprehension. You have to be able to have sense restraint. You have to know what is going on. You have to have awareness. You have to see that defilements are about to arise. You have the clear comprehension, the full awareness, sampajanya. Sampajanya is all about, again, as I said before, the ability to, you know, to hang out in the right place, to do those things that are conducive to the path. Yeah, when you do those things that are conducive to the path, sense restraint becomes possible. And what is the nutriment for that, for mindfulness and clear comprehension, is careful attention, or wise attention, yogiso manasikara. You have wide attention in the sense that you have to know what is good and what is bad. You have to have clarity about that. And this is one of the things the Buddha tells us in the suttas. He gives some instructions on what sometimes we don't even know what is good and what is bad in the world. So you have to have clarity about this. The more clarity you have about that, then your mindfulness and these other things can kick in as a consequence. Yogasumanasikara, very simple. It just means whenever you do something which leads to an improvement in your mind, yeah? Whenever you do something which leads to good states arising, bad states going down, that's yona somanasikarana. Whenever you do something which leads to bad qualities increasing, good qualities going down, that's ayona somanasikara, the opposite. Unwise attention, careless attention, heedless attention, etc. And where does that yona somanasikara come from? We've already gone through this before, so we know already. Faith. Yeah? Faith in the Buddha. Confidence in these teachings. Knowledge that the Dhamma is kind of heading you in the right way. Faith is such an important thing of the Buddhist path. What does really faith mean? Sadha. What is sadha? And sadha, of course, is the confidence in the triple gem, the confidence that the Buddha spoke the right thing, that he actually had an insight into reality. Yeah, confidence is a nice way of translating it. There's at least two different aspects to sadha. And one is what you might call the kind of the agreement with the teaching. You think, yeah, this makes sense, I agree with this. Yeah? That is one aspect of it. And this is, of course, an important part. Yeah? And then when you see the teachings are really kind of sensible, and they actually obviously have something to say about our life, then those aspects of the teachings which may not be so obvious to you, then you are willing to take those on board as well, because you have confidence in what the Buddha is talking about. So that is only one side of confidence. There's one other side to this thing we call faith. And that other side is the emotional aspect. Yeah, and the emotional aspect is in many ways even more important than the intellectual aspect. You can't really divide them, they come together. And the emotional aspect is this feeling that you are in the presence of this incredible treasure. Yeah, the Dhamma is like this treasure. It has the ability to give you everything you ever wanted. Yeah, a treasure is nothing by comparison to the Dhamma, because this is it. And I said so many times, it's the meaning of life. This is the answer to everything you ever wanted. And this feeling, this sense that this Dhamma has such incredible potential, when you feel that, it gives nice to joy, to happiness, a sense of, wow, I'm so lucky that I came across these teachings. I found the greatest thing that can possibly exist in the universe. These teachings can deliver me everything I ever wanted. Once you get that, it kind of, you must feel so blessed, right, that you actually are in the presence of these things. And that is the kind of joy, that is the kind of emotion we really want to tap into. When you tap into that, then the meditation becomes so easy. If you look at the suttas, suttas always talk about three things, or six things actually, sometimes three, sometimes six, things that we can reflect on to give rise to joy at the beginning of the path. And then, when that joy arises, the sequence I talked about before, the sequence of the bodhangas, it happens automatically because the joy is in place. So if you are able to get this feeling of this Dhamma, the Buddha being this incredible treasure that is right there in front of your eyes, and just a matter of applying it, then that whole sequence starts to happen. From having this good feeling about the Dhamma, the joy comes. When the joy comes, the rapture comes, the rapture, tranquility, happiness, samadhi, seeing things according to reality. One thing coming after the other, it's an automatic process. Yeah. So these are some of the ways of starting that joy, that spark, which sparks the whole process and allows it to come into existence. Yeah, it's just so wonderful that if you're able to do that, it's such a wonderful thing. Yeah. This is what inspiration is about. You get inspired. You can already translate the word Dhamma Veda. The Dhamma Veda occurs in this kind of context. Dhamma Veda means knowledge and feeling combined. Veda, it both means knowledge from Vicha, is also derived from that, and also refers to inspiration, feeling. And when inspiration and feeling come together like that, understanding and inspiration, it feels very powerful that your mind is drawn to it, and this process is undertaken as a consequence. This is what real sadhana is, yeah? The real confidence, powerful confidence in these teachings. The knowledge that you have uncovered something incredibly valuable, something that can sustain the whole life and give you everything that you ever wanted. Actually, give you much more than that. You didn't even know you wanted these things, yeah? But because you never knew about them, and suddenly you uncover, you think, "Whoa, jeepers, what is this? This is just astonishing." And then there's even more beyond that. And then you keep on going, keep on going. There's more than you could possibly ever dream of this path. The reason you can never dream of it, because you've never been there before. Yeah, the whole point is we're going to new territory. Yeah, so you're uncovering some amazing things. Sattva. What is the cause for sattva? Reading the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, hearing the true Dhamma. Sattva Dhamma Savana. Yeah? That is the root cause for that. And the more you read these teachings, the more you start to kind of get this feeling of being in the presence of something exceptional and remarkable. And then, the last factor here, how come you get to hear this thing? Because you hang out with the Buddha. Yeah, so hang out, spend more time with the Buddha. That's kind of the critical issue here. Sakurisa Sangseva, hanging out with the Aryans, the noble ones. And as you do that, you get to hear these teachings. Who are the noble ones in the world then? Well, you don't really know. Yeah, okay, sometimes you can guess a little bit, okay, maybe this monk, this nun, this Arya, yeah, I don't know what you think about Ajahn Brahm, I know what I think, I'm not going to tell you, but I know what I think. And there are also some other monks that I think are very interesting. I haven't spent enough time with them to really be able to know 100%, but they certainly are very powerful beings when they come into their presence. People like Ajahn Gamha, yeah, a very, very powerful person. And some people like that, Ajahn Shah, I never met Ajahn Shah, but I'm sure he was a very, very powerful person as well. But in the end, the Buddha is the real Arya, the real noble one. So you go back to the word of the Buddha. This is why this is so useful, to come back to the word of the Buddha. Hang out with the Buddha, yeah? Buddha is good company here. Yeah? So hang out with a good company. And remember, the Buddha is not dangerous. The Buddha is gentle. The Buddha is kind. And the Buddha speaks to you through the suttas, it's only for your benefit, because he has compassion for you, and because he knows he has the solution to all the problems and all the things that you ever wanted. Because he knows that, he has compassion and understanding combined. It's a very powerful thing that is. Remember how conditioned you are. Remember how strong your habits are. How difficult it is to break out of your habits. Have you noticed that? Yeah, sometimes the same person comes into your presence, they get the same reaction out of you because it's that same person. Yeah, our habits are often so ingrained. And the only way you're going to be able to break out of those habits and see the world in a new way is by reading the suttas of the Buddha, reading the word of the Buddha again and again, listening to the good Dhamma talks, inspire yourself, persevere in the practice, commit. Commitment and perseverance is the essence of what this path is about. If you do commit and persevere, there's no limit to what you can do on this path. Then you can break out of your old habits. You can see the world in a new way. Gradually, 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 emerging from darkness, coming into light. Breaking out of the eggshell, seeing the world for the first time. Yeah, wow, what happiness to see this world for the first time. This is what happens when you follow this path in this way. So listen to the words of Buddha and remember this beautiful simile further down, yeah, that the Buddha talks about. And simply just to read the very last part of the sutta. But it's so nice just to repeat that. Because associating with good persons becoming full fills up hearing the good Dhamma. Hearing the good Dhamma becoming full fills up the faith. Faith becoming full fills up the careful attention. Careful attention becoming full fills up the mindfulness and the clear awareness. Mindfulness and clear awareness becoming full fills up the restraint of the sense faculty. Restraint of the sense faculty becoming full fills up the three kinds of good conduct. The three kinds of good conduct becoming full fills up the four establishments of mindfulness. The four applications of mindfulness becoming full fill up the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening becoming full fill up true insight and liberation. Thus, there is a nutriment for true insight and liberation. In this way, they become full. Just then, when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on the mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full, fill up the legs. These becoming full, fill up the streams. These becoming full, fill up the rivers. And these becoming full, fill up the great ocean. Thus, there is nutriment for the great ocean. In this way, it becomes fuller. So too, associating with good persons becoming full, fills up here in the good Dhamma. And each stage fills up the subsequent one. The seven factors of awakening become full, fill up true insight and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true insight and liberation. In this way, they become full. Yeah, it's such a nice, beautiful way of remembering the Dhamma, the causality, how one thing leads to the next one. Really, the main thing in this kind of causal sequence, always come back to the initial one, always come back to the beginning thing. Never underestimate the power of your habits. Never underestimate the power of your conditioning from the past. Never underestimate the power of the defilements. And if you don't underestimate that, you will always come back to the teachings. Always make sure that the rain continues to rain on the mountaintop. And as it does so, eventually it will reach the ocean. Eventually the ocean itself will fill up. And the filling up of the ocean is the liberation, is the arising of avijja. From avijja, from darkness you go to light. And that is what happens as a consequence of that. So let us always do it. Roughly always do it. And the process happens by itself. Wonderful. And what happens then? What happens then is that when avijja is turned into vijja at the very base of the dependent origination, then dependent origination turns into an alternative sequence called dependent cessation. Yeah? Before, everything originated, everything came into being because of avijja. Now, we have the opposite effect instead. Everything starts to cease. Everything comes to an end. That is what's happening next. When you see reality as it actually is, what you start to understand is where true happiness lies. You know, true happiness does not lie in running after sensual pleasures in the world. True happiness rather lies in a completely different place. Sitting down, closing your eyes, becoming calm and peaceful inside. It's the exact opposite of running around in the world. That is where true happiness is found. Whenever the noble ones want to live in happiness, what do they do with that? They withdraw, they go into their cave, they go into solitude, into the forest, they sit down at the root of a tree, they close their eyes, watch their breath, and go into the jhana state. So that is how the noble ones enjoy themselves. Because that is where the true happiness is to be found. So you stop running after things, you stop trying to create happiness. Because the sankhara, that creating activity, is exactly where you do not find happiness. It is by stilling the sankharas, by not trying to create, that is where happiness is found. Yeah, that is what we start to realize. Instead of pursuing happiness in the wrong place, we pursue happiness where it is actually to be found. You also recognize the inherent impermanence of things in the world. So you stop chasing all those impermanent things. Yeah. There's another aspect of this. That also means no need to go running after all of these worldly pleasures. You understand the idea of non-self. And understanding of the idea of non-self means that you understand the limitations of what you can do in the world. You understand that the self that we have inside will never be able to create happiness for you. It is when you let go of the sense of self that is where happiness is to be found. Why? Because the sense of self always implies attachment. Sense of self always implies craving. Because that is what the self does. It owns things. It identifies with things. And those things that you identify and you own, you attach to those and you want to control them. That control is more sankharas. More sankharas is suffering. You already know that. You want to be peaceful, sincere. So all of this insight, when avijja is destroyed, when avijja comes to an end at the very root of dependent origination, when all you have left is vijja, the sankharas stop because you know you cannot create that happiness by creating things. It is by letting go of sankhara, by not creating, by being peaceful. That is where happiness is found. So you don't produce any sankharas anymore. Avijja. Vijja leads to the ending of sankhara. Sankhara Abhijanirodha Sankhara Nirodha. Yeah, from one comes the cessation of the other one. When you don't produce any sankhara, so remember the production of sankhara when we do, it's all about activities, yeah? It's all about how we live our lives, trying to create them. So when we create them, so we have good intentions or bad intentions. So. But when you don't create anything anymore, there's no intentional activity going on. Yeah, you're not intending towards anything in the future. You're not moving towards any aim. You're not doing anything. This conduct you have now doesn't affect your consciousness anymore. Because it's only when you have an intentional aim and you act on those intentions that you feel that I did good, I did bad. But if you don't do that anymore, your actions don't affect your consciousness. You stop feeling good or bad about yourself in that sense. Your consciousness is no longer linked to a particular level, because the level all depends on whether you feel good about yourself or bad about yourself. The link between sankhara and consciousness is broken. Consciousness is no longer standing in anything, no longer standing in your good actions or your bad actions. It's gone completely beyond that. So consciousness is released from this samsaric existence, whether it's high or low, because there's no influence from the sankharas anymore. Consciousness is gone beyond that. And because it has gone beyond that, when you die, because consciousness doesn't relate to any particular level, then when you die, it cannot go anywhere, because there is no level that it relates to. So, nama rupa and consciousness is binding together of, on the one hand, the knowing of the world, and on the other hand, the experiences that we have, which is nama rupa. That doesn't happen because consciousness just stops at that point. Yeah, it doesn't relate to any samsaric level. There's no establishment of consciousness. It comes to an end. And for that reason, there is no nama rupa, there is no more experience. That is the ending of the suffering. Yeah, nothing more happens. It is the greatest happiness that you can possibly achieve. What did Venerable Sariputta say in one of his famous verses in the Theragata? When you're an arahant, you are like a workman waiting for your wages. Yeah, it's Friday. You work hard all week. You want your wages. And so this is the Friday for the arahant. Yeah, it's Friday night. Now you get your wages. And consciousness stops, and that's it, that's the end of everything. Yeah. When consciousness stops, of course, no nama rupa. When there's no nama rupa, the whole thing afterwards also comes to an end. Yeah? There's nothing more going on. There's another way of looking at this, that is to look at it from the point of view of craving. Yeah? Why do we crave for things? The reason we crave for things is exactly the same as it is due to our avijja. Yeah? That's why we have craving. We crave because we want to create happiness for ourselves. If we know that we cannot create the happiness for ourselves, the craving stops because we cannot create it. It's by letting go of the craving, letting go of the doing, that happiness happens. Once you get that, craving has to stop. Because you don't crave for anything, you don't take anything up. Yeah, but the reason we take things up in the world, the reason we attach to things, is because we want to fulfill our cravings. No need to attach anymore. No need to take things up. Because we don't take anything up, in a sense, our existence is no longer related to all of those things. Our existence is beyond all of that. In a very real sense, we don't really exist anymore at all. And that is sort of true for the arahant, because the sense of self is gone. They don't really exist in any ordinary sense. If you look into the mind of an arahant, what do you see? You see emptiness. Yeah, there's nothing there. There's nothing holding on to anything in the world. There's no level that it belongs to. And then because it doesn't belong to any level, the consciousness isn't holding on to anything. The moment you die, there is no rebirth. It stops right there. This is roughly how it works. And this is how the cessation of samsara comes about. Sounds good about it? I'm not sure. It's good or it's bad, okay. Well, check it out. Keep on practicing and find out for yourself. As you get there, you start to understand why this is really good. So let's now look at the very last sutta. Yeah? So this is the practical example of how this actually comes about. The continuation of the great discourse on the ending of craving. So on seeing a form with the eye, yeah, because you now have practiced the full path, you become an arahant, this is what happens. We don't have any desire if the form is pleasing. Yeah, you know that that is counterproductive to have desire in it. You don't dislike it if it's unpleasing. Yeah, so you are kind of, your mind is very much equanimous, very much at ease. You abide with the mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, and you understand as it actually is, the deliverance of mind, the deliverance by wisdom, in which those bad, unwholesome qualities cease without remainder. You have seen things as they actually are. You know where the true deliverance, true freedom is to be found, because you've seen that you no longer are no longer interested in these things. In this way, you have abandoned favoring and opposing. Whatever feeling you feel, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, you don't delight in that, because you know it is not happiness anyway. Because you don't delight in it, you don't hold on to it, you don't welcome it. And as you don't do so, delight in feeling ceases in him. You don't delight in feeling anymore. You don't really care so much whether you have a, whether you are happy or, you know, whatever feelings come and go, they just come and go, and you are at ease with that. Because you don't delight in feeling, without comes the cessation of attachment. You don't attach anymore. With the cessation of attachment, there is a cessation of being. You look inside of yourself, you're just empty inside. With the cessation of being, the cessation of birth. The cessation of birth, aging, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, he does not lust after it if it is pleasing. He does not dislike it if it is unpleasing. With the cessation of his delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, the cessation of being or existence. With the cessation of existence, the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, old age, death, lamentation, sorrow, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. But to get there, all you have to do is practice the full path. And if you practice the full path in the right way, that is what happens. Everything comes to an end. Yeah, and you, and what a wonderful thing that is. How can things coming to an end be so much happiness? How can it be so happy when things have come to an end? Consciousness ceases. How can you see that? And again, come back to practical experience. If you think about these things too much, and you try to reflect on them and try to kind of understand intellectually how this ending of consciousness can be happiness, it can be very hard to grasp. But if you look at your personal experience again, come back to your meditation experience, see what happens when things start to fade away. Yeah, what is it like when you're thinking a little bit less? What is it like when the body is starting to fade away in meditation? And it always feels positive. Yeah, it is always a good thing. And the experience is inevitable that the more things fade away, the better you feel. Yeah, the ego starts to disappear. Actually, what is this big deal with the ego anyway? It's fading away and I feel so much better in it. Your body, everything starts to go away. The less that is present, the better you are. And after a while, it starts to dawn on you, this is a very good, very interesting process. If I keep on doing this in the right way, then I'm going to achieve more and more happiness as I go down the line. And then one day, you get into the fourth dharma, and you realize that even happiness itself, even the feeling of happiness, is a problem. You let go of all happiness, and when you let go of all feeling of happiness, you feel even more happy. So the paradoxes of the Dhamma start to come out, yeah, and you start to understand. They're not paradoxes at all. This is actually how it is. The less there is of anything, the better it is. Of course, if you don't have any good or bad feelings anymore, then if neutral feeling is the best, you start to become completely uninterested in feeling at that point, yeah? Feeling doesn't matter anymore, because being completely equanimous, having neither pleasure nor pain, that is the highest kind of happiness on the path. So be practical about it. Don't try to just think about it. If you think about it, you're going to be crazy after a while, because it's hard, you can't understand these things. These things are experiential realities, can only be understood through experience. And then you start to grasp what is going on here. People, when you ask the question, what is Nirvana? The problem with that question is that anyone, almost anyone who asks that question, they're coming from the wrong position when they ask it.
Yeah.
Because you're coming from the wrong position, you can't understand the answer. Yeah. So all you need to know about Nirvana is that it is the highest happiness. All you need to know, it is the ending of suffering. And then see in your meditation how a little bit more Nirvana, yeah? When you calm down in a meditation, yeah, when you become more at ease, what is happening is that you are nibbanaing a little bit. You are extinguishing a little bit. Things are disappearing. That's the meaning of extinguishing. Things are going away. So you are becoming a little bit more nibbana. This is what nibbana is. This is what nibbana is. Gee, I want more of that.
Renunciation,
yeah. That's what it is. You are renouncing things. And it feels so good, yeah. Renunciation is so great. People think renunciation is terrible because you have to give up all the happiness. No, you're giving up dukkha. Yeah, and you're getting happiness instead. That's what it's all about. So please don't be afraid of the Buddhist path. I'm always a bit concerned when I teach about these things, because these things are really profound, you know, and it's sometimes it's easy to be put off. So if a new person comes into the BJJ first time, don't tell him these things straight away, yeah? Because you will never see them again. That's the wrong teaching for me, yeah? And so go gradually. And this is one of the beautiful things about the Buddha in the Suttas. When he teaches us, he always teaches a little bit according to our reality. There is a very famous sutta of a monk called Vajragotha. And Vajragotha asks the Buddha these kind of questions. He asks, what happens to the arahant after he dies? He asks the Buddha, point blank, yeah? And the Buddha just looks at him and doesn't answer the question. And then after he's left, Venerable Ananda said, why didn't you answer him? Because he wouldn't have understood, said the Buddha. He would just have been confused, yeah? And he would have kind of even fallen off the path. So he didn't answer, so Vajragotha goes away, disappointed, this Buddha, he doesn't know what he's talking about, or something like that. But then he comes back again, because there's something about the Buddha, something about his teachings that always draw you back again. And then he comes back again, and then when he's ready, the Buddha gives him the profound teachings. And then he becomes an arahant, later on. So this shows you, if we teach people in the right way at the right time, there's incredible opportunity for growth, and incredible opportunity for happiness and joy, and all these positive things on the Buddhist path. So, there you are. That is, that's that. Yeah? So, yes, please, let me forget. I know your name now, so now I can.
When you talk about Sankha,
right?
A lot of people would associate it as indifference.
Yeah.
So can you explain between indifference and Sankha?
Okay. Yeah. So the distinction between indifference and upekkha. Well, indifference is like you don't care, yeah? That's what it means. You don't really care. Yeah, people die in war, yeah, whatever. It's just samsara, you know, so don't worry about it. That is the wrong kind of approach to life. People think that they are being equanimous. People think that they're letting go. They're not actually letting go at all. They just don't care. That's the problem. That's a big difference. Really letting go is a very different thing from that. So real equanimity is more like your mind is so stable and so powerful that you are able to look at the suffering in the world without being affected by it yourself. Yeah, it doesn't affect you in a powerful way. You don't start crying, oh no, there's so much suffering in the world. And you don't kind of, because you know that state of equanimity you have is even better than all the other, any other state outside. So with equanimity, it's not that you don't care, you care. But you don't allow it to affect yourself, that you have an even state of mind. Yeah? And the other one is that you, because you don't care, you're able to keep an even state of mind. Here, the even state of mind comes first, and because of that, you have equanimity. So when you have equanimity, you still do good things for the world. The Buddha had the highest equanimity. He understands the suffering of being. He's not affected by the suffering, then he understands it. He knows that it's there, so he still acts to help people. The whole of the Buddha's life is an act of compassion, of looking after people, understanding that he has the answer to the problems of humanity. That the Buddha would much rather sit in a cave somewhere and just meditate, yeah? Because he has access to the deepest happiness through just being completely still and peaceful. But even though it is some suffering for him to go out and teach the world, still he does that because of the compassion. That is the real equanimity. And equanimity doesn't stop you from acting if it is a good one. Indifference stops you from acting. So when people say, I just let go, sometimes they don't let it go at all. Sometimes it just means they aren't really bothered, I can't really care. Yeah? That is the wrong kind of letting go. The real letting go is the letting go where you that you do in your meditation practice, letting go of the self, letting go of the activities, yeah? In meditation, there's the right time to let go and the wrong time to let go. And the letting go of the meditation is kind of one aspect of it. But the thing is also that, you know, you're one of the things that let go of is attachments in the world. And sometimes we think that we cannot be, we cannot act properly, we cannot actually be effective in the world without attachments, but you can be very effective in the world without attachments. The less attachments you have, yeah, some people think that's the same as a difference, but it isn't the same as a difference. It just means that you have more clarity about what you're doing, and what less attachments actually means. Because you have more clarity, you're more able to respond in an appropriate way to what is required in a situation. Yeah, the more attachments you have, the less ability you have to respond in an appropriate way. Why? Because you have less of an interest in the outcome. You have a degree, by less of an interest, I mean that the outcome matters to you, yeah? If it is your child, you want the child to behave in a certain way, yeah? So you have a less of an interest because it affects you if the child behaves badly. But if you're not attached to the child in the same way, then you, instead of getting angry and upset, you will think of the child in a different way. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense anymore, but anyway, I'm talking a lot, so hopefully that will work. I'm getting a bit tired now, to be honest. Many hours, yeah, of talking, so that's part of the problem. So, any last minute? You have a few minutes left, if you want to ask any last minute things. Is anyone who's going to go home and attempt to convert to different religions straight away? Okay, good. Otherwise, I get really sold off that around on the back. But what? I've heard the rumors from coming over to Kerala. That's good. Anything else we should cover then? What we should say then? What we should mention then? Anybody happy then? Okay. We're going to have a Q&A session afterwards, probably then. Yeah? Okay. So let's just have a little bit longer break. We'll come back in at 4:30 then. Have some more meditation together and have the last Q&A session left. Okay.